welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists. We'll open our meeting with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping with the principles expressed here in the Declaration, the Lodge here in Philadelphia holds two weekly meetings. On Wednesday evenings, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. We are in the middle of the chapter on the fifth principle, the mind, and the subject for this coming Wednesday is the higher and lower mind. Now on Wednesdays, from 5:15 to 7:15, we have the library available. There's always a student volunteer there to help you with your independent research you might be interested in. Plus there's a availability of the reference for that evening's study class. The library hours, set are from 5:15 to 7:15 on Wednesdays, and then we have our class from 7:30 to 8:30. On Sunday mornings, the doors open at 10:30, and we have our meeting from 11 to 12. The format is more of a formal presentation, either by lecture as today, or a shorter talk, a forum, or a panel. And today we are finishing up on the umbrella theme of cycles and cyclic law, and looking at the subject of the new year, the new cycle. Now starting next Sunday, we will enter the January theme of tools for spiritual evolution, which is really an extension of today's presentation. And on January 7th, the subject will be the power of will and desire. Now also, we have available a book table upon which are displayed the straight-line theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, magazines, available at cost. The book table is open before and after meetings and during library hours. Now, a reading has been selected to introduce today's talk on the New Year, New Cycle, and it is from The Voice of the Silence. All nature thrills with joyous awe and feels subdued. The silver star now twinkles out the news to the night blossoms. The streamlet to the pebbles ripples out the tale. Dark ocean waves will roar it to the rocks surf-bound. Scent-laden breezes sing it to the vales. And stately pines mysteriously whisper, a master has arisen, a master of the day. Behold the mellow light that floods the eastern sky. In signs of praise both heaven and earth unite. And from the fourfold manifested powers a chant of love ariseth, both from the flaming fire and flowing water, and from sweet-smelling earth and rushing wind. Hark, from the deep, unfathomable vortex of that golden light in which the victor bathes, all nature's wordless voice in thousand tones ariseth to proclaim, joy unto ye, O men of earth, a new and additional savior of mankind is born.
The reading that we just heard really sounded like a Christmas carol, didn't it? In signs of praise, both heaven and earth unite. And even as children, we would sing, and heaven and nature sing. It's all very familiar to us. But when was what we just heard written? It wasn't written by H.P. Blavatsky. She says that she had learned many of these precepts by heart and gathered them together into three segments of what she called the Voice of the Silence. Well, when was that written? I mean, the material that she was using. From the preface to The Voice, she said, the work from which I here translate forms part of the same series as that from which the stanzas of the Book of Zohn were taken, on which the secret doctrine is based. So when you're reading The Voice of the Silence, you are reading the secret doctrine from a different approach. This book of the Golden Precepts, one of the works put into the hands of mystic students in the East, some of which are pre-Buddhistic. Well, if some of what's in the Voice is pre-Buddhistic, and everything else is much earlier, we can at least go from the value of when was the Buddha? 623 BC. So the material that we find in the Voice must be at least 2,900 years old. Well, if that's so, then who or what is being celebrated in those words that we heard? You hear a lot about this time of year now in contrast to Christmas. You'll see online mention of the pagan celebrations at the same time of the year and equally of the winter solstice. But the recognition is not there that all of these manifestations of celebration of historical or mythological characters all come from the winter solstice. The winter solstice is the basis of the celebration of the cycle. We are in the period at which the sun, entering the sign of Capricorn, has since December 21st stopped to advance in the southern hemisphere, and then Cancer, crab-like, begins to move back. You know, the word solstice means stick, not move. So we have the summer solstice and the winter solstice, and then we have the equinox, where the times are equal. So the advance of the sun in the southern hemisphere sticks. And if it didn't begin to move backwards, the earth would not have any habitation on it. So it is in this particular time of the year that every civilization celebrated the sun god as being born, because it is the sun returning to help and heat and have the world be as it is. So anyone born in the northern hemisphere is always part of that celebration of November 25th. Ages before Christ, the Persian Mithra, the Egyptian Osiris, the Greek Bacchus, the Phoenician Adonis, the Phrygian Athis were all born of virgin mothers at the winter solstice. It is mythological, it is allegorical, it represents stages of development of the wise one they are speaking of. At Memphis, the people were shown the image of the god Day, D-A-Y, born December 25th. The Romans marked it as the day of the birth of the sun. So when we read about these individuals, we are also reading about a cyclical fact in nature and in life. We're going to read some quotes from two articles by HPB. We've left the pamphlets on the book table because the articles are in there, and the total article is worth reading, both cases. In The Year is Dead, Long Live the Year, HPB wrote, "Sad derision of human destiny. So many saviors of the world born into it, so much and so often propitiated, and yet the world is as miserable, nay, far more wretched now than ever before, as though none of these saviors had ever been born." And then in her article, 1888, she wrote, "Let no one imagine that it is a mere fancy, the attaching of the importance of the birth of the year. The earth passes through its definite phases, and man with it. And as a day can be colored, so can a year. The astral life of the earth is young and strong between Christmas and Easter. Those who form their wishes now will have added strength to fulfill them consistently." Oh, along with everything else, the fingers don't work. The earth, this is taken sentences from what we just read. The earth passes through definite phases and man with it. This is a cycle of rebirth of the inner psychic and spiritual energy which permeates the globe and permeates us. It is a period of awakening. And many people would question that. Why don't we celebrate this in the spring, where we literally see the awakening, the buds coming up from the ground? Well, there wouldn't be any spring if it weren't for this season. The seeds and all life is underground now, waiting for the cycle of spring. But if it were not for the winter solstice covering them, protecting them, preventing them from coming up, we wouldn't have a spring. The two go together. And many of us know, this happened last year, that so many of the things coming up from the ground were dead before they could bloom because it was too cold. So it is a cycle of awakening, but protecting as well. In this cycle of renewal, all that we desire to do has a greater impulsion than in any other time of the year. Shakespeare said it perfectly. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which when taken at the flood leads to success. In other words, if you know when to put your boat in the water, you'll be successful. And that's what this cycle is. And then the line, as a day can be colored, so can a year. We ask you to listen to very carefully to these words of hers. Thoreau pointed out that there are artists in life, people who can change the color of a day and make it beautiful to those with whom they come in contact. We claim that there are adepts, masters in life, who make it divine, as in all other arts. Is it not the greatest art of all, this which affects the very atmosphere in which we live? That it is the most important is seen at once, when we remember that every person who draws the breath of life affects the mental and moral atmosphere of the world and helps to color the day for those about him. Think about that. Every person who draws the breath of life affects the mental and moral atmosphere of the world and helps to color the day for those about them. Whether we recognize that as spiritual beings, we are responsible for the atmosphere of the world we now inhabit. We all do know that certain individuals can enter a room and we feel better just because they're there. Equally the opposite, someone we don't even know can enter a room and we feel depressed or saddened or weakened. We assume, perhaps, that that says something about our ability to read someone else, but it isn't that at all. It's the fact that we are all one and the same, and the coloring of someone around us affects us. We have, of course, the right and the power to stand above and beyond that affecting. But more importantly, we need to recognize that is what we do. As a matter of fact, they say one of the things about certain restaurants is you don't want to go there if the chef is in a bad mood. Because literally, that food will make you sick. Maybe not that day, but it will become part of your system, that nastiness, that ugliness. It makes us realize what an important effect we have on everything around us. There are people who will walk into this building who've never been here before and will let out a big sigh. And if you ask them, they will say something along the line of, I feel peace. I feel sanctuary. I feel safe. Well, that is the impression, not necessarily of us. We haven't been here long enough to make that big an effect, but the impression of all those who had been coming and studying here and devoting themselves to this work. But all of us leave an impression everywhere we go. Actually, in Isis Unveiled, HPB speaks of the fact that if someone drowned in a lake and they couldn't find the body, they would take a piece of his or her clothing and throw it out onto the water, and it would go and sink where the individual was. We don't know if anyone's trying that in our modern day world. But. So, if we have unrecognized within ourselves that ability to color the world, which we're doing whether we choose to or not, whether we choose the colors or not, we are doing it. we can see that in this cycle of awakening, of rebirths, of new beginnings, we could begin to set up some practices within ourselves that would allow us to change the way we color the world. It is said that these festivals that were celebrated around the world in every culture, every civilization, that we know as Easter and Christmas and New Year's, were instituted by wise beings to teach us to share gift-giving, to teach us to feel compassionate, to feel the awesomeness of the divine in nature and in humanity. So these customs are worth knowing about, but are even more worth realizing what it means to us as an individual. It is so interesting that in January we're going to be having tools for spiritual evolution, because you could not get a more important tool than what you're hearing about today. But like any thing with power, it has its dual edge. We have to be very careful how we use this tool, because we can literally harm ourselves by using it the wrong way, which we probably have been most of our life. And we're talking about New Year's resolutions. People take them on a whim, just to be cool, just to do what everybody else is doing. And they are making resolutions that are not resolutions, that are wishes. It's more like, oh, I wish I was smarter, I wish I was stronger, I wish I weighed less, I wish. And has nothing to do with resolving. A resolve is a promise that you make to yourself and to life. And any promise is a serious thing. So the reason it weakens ourselves is that we are making a statement that we will to do something, and we have no intention of doing it. We just wish it were done, that's all. And that weakens our own will. We harm ourselves that way. So Theosophy warns us, make a resolution because you are determined to act on it, to follow it through. So think seriously about it. Will you do this? Do you really want to do this? Because behind will stands desire. So it isn't just, I want to have the result. It's that I want to make the effort to get the result. The other warning is, do not make negative resolutions. And it's so reasonable, so common sense. Suppose you don't want to eat so much chocolate, and you say to yourself, I will eat less chocolate. Every time you think of your resolution, what are you thinking of? Chocolate. Instead, you decide what you will eat in place of. So you say to yourself, I intend to eat more honey. And then when you're thinking about your resolution, you then come across some chocolate. No, I'm going to have honey. I know that's a stupid example, but you can think of your own. Make it positive. One of the hardest ones to do that way is smoking, because you are saying, I am giving up smoking. So every time you think about it, you're thinking about smoking. You have to replace the thing with something that you do want. So instead you think, I will breathe only fresh air. You want a cigarette? It won't work. So you go for the positive, not the negative. Now you are, at that moment, changing a cycle within a cycle that's a cycle of creativity. In other words, you've got the entire universe behind you. There is no reason for you to fail if you sincerely take the time to decide, I am going to do this step by step, bit by bit. All you have to do is be successful once, and then you recognize the power, and that recognition allows you to actually do it more quickly than you thought you could ever do it. It's a question of trusting what we're learning. And that might be the best resolution for the beginning. And that is to resolve to study this very issue, either in the sense of who and what am I? What is a spiritual being? How can I discover that for myself? What will I study? Go and ask an older student. How did you do it? What did you read? What did you learn from? Go and decide for yourself what you will do to increase your knowledge so that you can increase your wisdom. It's a good place to start. But anywhere that your heart tells you you need to go, figure out a resolution that will help you, that you know you'll be able to fulfill. Some of the recent, I don't know what word I want, history, recognition in science is that it takes 21 days to create a habit. 21 days is nothing. If we can stick to that, then our resolution is set in stone and we can rest and relax a little bit. But by Easter is when we see the bloom of that effort that we have put forward. It has become a part of our nature, and we can rest in it and think of other things that we could resolve in the future. It's good to sort of keep that in mind all year. But the funny thing is, today is New Year's Eve, right? Because tomorrow is the start of the new year. Well, not for students of esotericism. January 4th is the start of the new year. Because, and we'll have to read this, 14 days after the winter solstice, which is December 21st, is the date of the beginning of the new year, because it is the day that is sacred to Mercury, the giver of wisdom, said to have incarnated under the 10th sign of the zodiac, Capricorn. In other words, perihelion day, that's when the earth is closest to the sun, is the day of the incarnation of the Dionys. It will make our resolutions wise and planned out if we wait till that day. Take it from now and ponder your resolutions so that you're making them on January 3rd before the new year of January 4th. This is again from 1888. Man's life is in his own hands. His fate is ordered by himself. Why then should not this year be a year of greater spiritual development than any we have lived through? It depends on ourselves to make it so. And let no one imagine that it is a mere fancy, the attaching of importance to the birth of the year. The earth passes through its definite phases, and man with it. And as a day can be colored, so can a year. The astral life of the earth is young and strong between Christmas and Easter. Those who form their wishes now will have added strength to fulfill them consistently. In one of these articles, she also warns that we shouldn't go around saying Happy New Year to each other. That we should say instead, be your best self. Your questions are invited. Yes?
The class started out with the reading.
You'll have to be a little louder.
The class started out with a reading of the voice of the silence.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was there that as the new Arhan, our Savior, is born, all nature responds. So we were wondering, it is said that we get benefit from the rising tide in nature, but is it not true the reverse also, that the resolutions we make to spiritually advance ourselves have a greater effect on nature at this time?
Yes, it is a reciprocal universe. We color and affect not just the people around us, but the very nature around us. And, you know, we often don't think about it. We take in air. We take in minerals. We take in vitamins. We take in substance by eating. And that is colored and impressed by us. And ask anyone who's ever lost their temper during a dinner or just after they've eaten, and you know that you're sicker than you would have been. You've colored everything so viciously. If it didn't work that way, then how could humanity ever grow? It has to be a reciprocity. And we know there are quotes everywhere that all nature is waiting for man to wake up and take the position that man is the master or the wise one to teach the lower. We thought of a phrase and it's gone. Oh, that the lion should lie down with the lamb is in the Bible. And the reason it's there is the reason the lion attacks is because it acts as a safety valve for our negative, passionate desires for cruelty and revenge and horrible things that we feel collectively that gather together and need a safety valve for expression. So if we were not the way we are, the lion would not lie down with the lamb. We don't know if any of you have ever watched on Facebook some of the nature things where they show a lion rescuing a hurt creature that normally they would attack. I mean, they're amazing things. So some of that is out there already. But we have made the world the way it is, not just geographically, politically. It's all the way through from the astral to the physical. Yes.
Well, in the beginning, it was alluded to that
a little louder.
In the beginning, it was alluded to that next week's talk on desire and will has a great deal to do with this. Mm-hmm. And we see that our desire is very important here. Mm-hmm. But isn't our desire in this sense more than a wish? Because, you know, we can wish, you know, which seems rather not really concentrated, but it's just sort of whimsical. Mm-hmm. Where when we resolve to do something, it's really one of long consideration. Mm-hmm. It may have been for the whole year, or maybe for years.
The whole life, yeah.
You've been considering this, but not knowing how to make that first step. And I think that the idea of a resolution and desire and this time of year, and the strength that we can gather from the movement of the earth,
from the cycle,
is one that we should really look at and see if we can.
The fact that we mentioned that most people do it on a wish, it's just some sort of fashionable thing. They're not really thinking about what they're willing to do to make that idea happen. Even if you've been pondering something for a long time, if you don't set up the foundation for being able to act on that desire, then you will probably fail at it. So we repeat the warning. It's very important to consider what you will do before you commit to your resolutions. Yes?
However, doubt is it strangles us.
Yes.
That we become like glued in our tracks. Mm-hmm. So, it keeps us returning to the Gita. But however, doubt, we want to make this gigantic resolution to really change our life in a very positive way. And we get the old personality comes flooding in.
Right.
Maybe not right away, but what did you just say? What are you doing? Are you silly? And that's what the conversation. So we know that we've had that one.
Someone wise said though that doubt is the beginning of wisdom. If you just rush along as though you already know everything, then you're going to have problems. It's a question of knowing yourself. Some people know themselves very well. If you make a list of the things you want, not wish, but want, I really want these things, I'm willing to work towards them. And on the other side, you make an evaluation that's not from your personality, an evaluation of how well am I going to be able to do at this. It's like wanting to be a basketball player, but you're 5'1". But some people manage to accomplish such things. So you've got to look at what you want as opposed to what you're willing to work at. Yes?
Is a resolve the same as a vow?
Yes, in essence it really is. Although usually a vow is made to someone or something, a resolution is a vow made within yourself. And that's one of the reasons that we take it so casually. I mean, all right, so I disappointed myself, I'll live through it. But no, you've hurt yourself by doing it. So, yes.
Should we tell people when we're making a resolution or a vow on what it is?
I think it depends on the person. Some of us, if we tell, we're going to be too embarrassed to fail. We may eventually fail anyway, but it helps keep us moving. And that's an ego thing. It depends if it could encourage someone else to do something as well. We think that's a very individual thing. We don't think you should boast about it. But what do you think? Yes.
Oh, it could be a way to keep yourself accountable, mm-hmm. or like an honesty type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It would depend on the individual. The point is, the whole thing does happen in secret. I mean, even if you tell people, I have resolved to lose weight, it's in secret because nobody's walking around with you, watching you make your decisions. So it is a secret thing. But we don't think it hurts to let the people around you know what you're up to, especially if you're in a family. Because the division of things like food shopping and food preparing and stuff is, it usually falls to one person and they have to handle the change for the one who's trying to lose weight. Yes?
We can think of a specific case where it might be helpful where, say, two people in the same family both have the same resolution. Mm. By telling one another, they add support and strength. But also, would there be any additional strengthening to the vow if we were also to write it down?
Oh, absolutely. Not only write it down, but keep a record of yourself within that. This is what I did today. This is where I let myself down. And to try to figure out why. What tempted me to go against what I want? Now that's another thing that seems to be very human, is fail at something. We've read about people who've been on a diet for months and done very well, and then went on a binge weekend, and then absolutely felt they were a failure and went off the diet completely and ended up gaining more than they had ever lost. So it isn't that, oh, look, I didn't live up to it, therefore I'm a failure. It's, oh, look, I have things to learn here. There are ways to prevent myself from falling into that hole again. You know, failure can lead to a lot of wisdom. Yes?
So writing it down, making it like a meditation.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we write it down and we look at it daily or weekly, and it sort of lingers in our mind, you know, that that we try to make the resolution as high and as spiritual
right.
as we can.
Well, we try to also, this is going to sound stupidly dramatic, but to sort of set it in letters of fire inside ourselves. If we could only realize we don't want to disappoint ourselves. If you stop and think about it for a minute, you just, what I've been incarnating for 18 million years, and this is as far as I've gotten? Oh, come on. We need some energy. We need some words of fire and flame to make ourselves realize what power we have, what power we're wasting. Yes.
Well, we think that would be a good image to think of it in fire, because that's the spiritual essence of everything.
Yes.
Is fire, and it's also would be burning off the dross.
Mm-hmm. And this is the Festival of Lights. That's what the winter solstice is. The light and the fire and the heat returning to the north. Yes.
The suggestion was that those who make their vows or resolutions at this time get the added benefit of nature. But is that enough? Don't we have to make or renew that vow or resolution every day for it to be effective? For example, Buddha said that he who conquers themselves is greater than the conqueror
of
nations.
Worlds.
So this is not an
yeah.
easy thing. We have to work on it or commit ourselves to it every day, not just one day out of the year.
Well, we think, and perhaps in this we're naive, we think just getting up in the morning and knowing that you have promised yourself you will or won't do certain things is facing that resolution every day. But maybe it would be a good idea to have it written out and literally read it when you get up in the morning. Yes?
Yeah, a lot of resolutions and vows have to do with motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that if your doctor tells you we have to get bludgeoned into making these resolutions sometimes. And we have to really feel strong about it, or it's not even worth making. And writing it down and keeping it on the forefront of your mind, things like that, is a great idea. But you got to really want it. Or, it's just, or
right.
you're right, you're just taking up air with a wish.
We think one thing, if you're at all creative or artistic, is you can have fun with it. You can create for yourself, if you're artistic enough, or else you use what you can find out there in the world. Make a literal picture of what you see as the future. I mean, if you feel weak and puny and, I don't know, pathetic, picture yourself as someone strong and resolute. And that can be part of your imaging, your motivation. You know, the sad thing about all of this is that you only have to be successful once to know that it's true. And once you know that it's true, it's almost embarrassing, because you could have made yourself quite wonderful and helpful to humanity by now. But do and work from where you find yourself. You know, Mr. Crosby says, and we think it's helpful and hopeful to realize this, that we have no idea, absolutely no idea where we are nor do we know this about anyone else, that we're like an iceberg. We're only seeing the very tip of the iceberg, what needs to be worked on right now. And then Mr. Judge tells us in the Gita notes that we may very well and probably have been through initiations, but it's blocked from us now because we have to fix whatever is in the way of the next initiation. Maybe we're greedy, maybe we're selfish, maybe we're moody, maybe we have some attachment to something. We have to figure it out before we can go further. But we mustn't assume that we are less than a spiritual being in evolution. We have no idea. So if we take where we stand and motivate ourselves, and the best motivation is from that children's song, go forth, children of light, go forth. What is the next sentence?
Render gentle service.
Children of service.
And what?
Render
gentle service unto all that lives. That's all we have to do, and that's not even that difficult. You don't have to be rich or pretty or smart to render gentle service. Yes?
Well, that brings us to the idea that's expressed in the Gita, is that we need to free ourselves from the pair of opposites. And it was just a general statement that's made, but that's how we see the world, in these pair of opposites. So if we free ourselves from them, we open up a whole new dimension.
Right.
And I think it was expressed in that last comment.
I think add a word to that, because people think freeing yourself from something means being completely removed from it. It's free ourselves from our attachment. We have lists in our heads that are amazing. I like this, I don't like that. I want this, I don't want that. It takes a lot of time to keep up with those lists. You divorce yourself from that. It doesn't matter whether I like it or not. It doesn't. It's there for me to deal with. Yes?
We like the image of Janus.
The two-faced God.
Two-faced God, but also actually three-faced, because it's looking at the present as well.
Oh.
It's looking back and forward, but concentrating on the present. And it's the janitor with the keys to the kingdom. It's with Janus the janitor.
Janitor. That's very funny. Yes.
In the talk, it was mentioned about the Dhyanis incarnating, or at least the commemoration of that event.
January 4th.
Mm-hmm. So what happened when they incarnated? What resulted from that?
What's the result? It was a long time ago, but we are the result. You know, we're told that when we, as spiritual beings, incarnated into infant humanity, that there was no speech because there was no speech necessary, that we were all of one mind and could communicate just by being in someone else's presence. No words, no language. And we were taught by those Dhyanis, those spiritual beings walked among us, and we were taught the arts, the sciences, everything that we have that we think is our creation, our humanity's stepping stones showing this mastery of life, came from universal mind. And we were inducted, introduced, made to realize that we were connected to that, that we were part of universal mind. When that line of spiritual beings stepped back so that we could begin to grow and use what we had been given, we were then called human beings. That is the human, the incarnation of the spiritual into the physical or the substance and material. And from then on, we have been on our own with our connection to those higher beings. But because we are as we are, they have continued to incarnate and bring us back these teachings. And there's some place where HPV says that we, as humanity, are a million years behind, that we have not stepped away from certain things and we're stuck. But if we again turn to Mr. Crosby and he talks about us and how we are at this moment as individuals, it's our fault. Because those who have but a spark of mind cannot do this on their own. They need us, those who have an understanding of the fact of our divinity. They need us to stand forward and set the example and be their instructors, the way the wise ones are the instructors to us. So we have a serious responsibility. But we don't have to be depressed about it because we have serious tools for evolution. And in working as a group, we all get the benefit of each other's efforts, mentally, morally. So we're very lucky to have what we have. Yes.
But even though it's considered the occult New Year, that idea still permeates throughout all the different religions. Mm-hmm. We know at this time of year, so many of them have the idea of the lighting of candles.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, mind was lit up.
Yes.
Like one candle lighting many at that time.
And the beauty of that allegory, and we saw it once and never got over it. It was an Easter service at a Greek Orthodox church. And it was very strange to enter the church totally dark. I mean, totally dark. There were no lights. And people guided you to your seat. And you were given a candle in a little cup. And at midnight, they started singing, Christos Anesti, Christ has risen. And the priest came out with a candle. And each man, woman, and child went up and lit their candle from that candle. And the realization that that flame was never reduced by sharing it. And I think that's a very big thing to suddenly realize. A flame is not reduced by lighting a million other candles. So then the whole church was blazing with light and rejoicing. I mean, that's a very, very powerful imagery. And in all the festivals around the world, going back in time, it's the festival of light. Yes.
Well, that's a great image for altruism as well.
Mm-hmm.
When you do selflessly for others, you're gaining, even though that shouldn't be your everyone gains. It's throughout the world, really. Every kind deed.
Then what should our motive be?
Selfless service to others.
Yes, but how can we word it so that we can wake up in the morning and go, okay, I got it.
Just try to make somebody smile, that's all. Just
mm-hmm. Be kind.
Yeah.
Be honest. Be fair. Maybe collect little phrases that help remind you of these important things. It is spiritual food that we need. We have so much right now. Do you realize how wealthy we are? There are people without food, without water, without warmth, without any sort of hope. We have all those things. So we could share in ways, spend a little time each day sending out the best thoughts you can, yes.
But the most dramatic changes in my life in particular we're not from seeing the light, but from feeling the heat.
Isn't that funny? You can't have light without heat. It's such a sad thing to realize how much time we have wasted. Of course, that's karmic. You know, we didn't come to this wisdom until we had earned the right to come to this wisdom. So it's what we do with it now that determines how quickly we'll come to it the next time. We recall saying to an older student that we wanted to rush out to the redwood forests and carve the three fundamentals on one of the trees. And he said, why? We said, because it'll be there when we come back. He said, oh, you mean you don't know you're carving it in yourself right now? And that's what we do with our negatives and our positives. We literally carve them in ourselves. We have to heal ourselves, remake ourselves, and make ourselves so that we can be the better able to help and teach others. And that is so easy to recognize, because how would you know what you know right now if it weren't for others? Can you think of one thing that you ever thought or did that was strictly yours? No. It came from others, from sharing what others know, or maybe even sometimes for reacting against what others taught you or told you. Everything is from an amalgamation of other minds, other hearts, other feelings. And then we decide what we will make of that, what we will use of that. Yes.
I think the strongest impressions in life are those people who care about you, you know, and demonstrate it by paying attention to you, you know, and being helpful, and always, as was said, trying to be helpful, but not enslave you in anything, but, you know, right. Just trying to be helpful, cooperative.
You know, one of the things that we could resolve to do that wouldn't cost us anything, and that's to pay more attention, to be more aware to the people and things going on around us. We were in a train station where they had roped off an area peculiarly, and it was a big train station, hundreds of people sitting around waiting. And a blind woman came in and got into the side of the line, and it was obvious where they had set the repairs up, that must have been the way in. So she just stood there, and the rest of the line kept moving forward and getting taken care of. And she just stood there waiting. And we're looking around. These people must know this area. I don't. So I finally got so disgusted, I went up and I took her by the arm and I said, are you waiting to buy a ticket? And she said, yes, almost implying, leave me alone. And I said, well, you're not in the line. And she said, yes, I am. I said, you can't see that you're not in the line. Trust me. And I moved her to the front of the line. And some of the people started to push forward. And I said, you could have done this, you know. And then left her there, and she was next. I mean, we're not paying attention. We're paying attention to ourselves. I'm next in line. You know, yeah, she's been standing there a while. That's her problem. We need to take responsibility for what's going on around us. If we see someone drop something, tell them or pick it up. If we see somebody struggling with something, offer to help them. You may frighten them. This is a very suspicious world now. We had a lady, we offered to carry her bags for her. She was frightened. She started to run. And I said, here, take my purse. I'll take your bags. We got to her door a few blocks down, and she grabbed her things, dropped my purse, got inside the door, and you could hear her lock it. That's horrible. to be that afraid of other human beings. That's awful. But that doesn't change the fact that we need to reach out from a higher place in ourselves and sort of see what's going on in the world, because we are beings of love and of wisdom, and we have all the tools we need. Meeting is adjourned.